Okay, so it is 6 o'clock. Welcome everyone.
Welcome everyone.
My name is Paula Turns. Tonight we are going to be doing the illustrious about creating change. If you haven't done this, introduce yourselves in the chat window, telling us what you teach, where you teach, and what your Twitter handle is if you have one. And while you're doing that, I would like to tell you a little bit about how Global Math Department works. These meetings are recorded and they're available a few hours after the meeting ends. So if you would like to watch it, or even better, get one of your colleagues or friends or family or whoever to come and watch it, because they are always fabulous presentations, they can come back to the exact same URL that you used to get in here tonight. The Global Math Department does pride itself on being friendly and supportive, so know that that chat room is available for topical and general conversation. If you have questions, pop them in that little chat window, and if Audrey does not catch them, I will be watching for all of your questions to make sure that they all get answered. As I said earlier, our speaker tonight is Audrey Mendeville. And a little bit about Audrey. She still identifies as a secondary math teacher in Southern California, even though she does not have her own classroom anymore. She taught high school math in Southern California for 11 years before being pulled from the classroom to support secondary math teachers throughout her district. After 3 years of that work, she made the jump from her district to the San Diego County Office of Education, where she is a math coordinator supporting secondary math teachers and students throughout that region. She's passionate about every student making sense of mathematics and dedicated to supporting secondary mathematics teachers to make this happen. When she's not at work, she enjoys being a mom to her 6-year-old son and 3-year-old daughter, watching them make sense of the world around them. You can find her on Twitter at Audrey_Mendeville. And tonight, as I said, she will be talking about creating professional learning for change. So without further ado, Audrey, take it away.
Thanks, Paula. I'm really excited to be here with you all tonight, although I'm a little bit nervous because those who know me well know I don't even like really talking on the phone because I can't see people's faces or get visual clues back. So this is a little bit of a stretch for me, but I hope that the experience will be valuable for all of you who are there, and I'm hoping to learn a lot from you as well. So I look forward to hearing from you through that chat, and like Paula said, she'll be keeping an eye out for me on the questions as well. Just to be a quick disclaimer, I often abbreviate professional development into PD, and I don't even realize I do it. So I'm trying my best to not use acronyms, but that's one I fall into. So if that's not one you usually use, I might accidentally slip into it. If I make any others, feel free to call me out on them in the chat window, and I will do my best to explain what I'm slipping into my vernacular. So I'm going to go ahead and start us off with some proposed norms. And I know this seems pretty odd because we're not all sitting in a room together, but I just want you to take a moment to read over these and see if these are things that you can agree to as we participate in this little seminar together for the next few minutes. And if there's any that need to be changed, you can call it out in the chat window, but if you're okay with them, I'd like you to think about one of those that you might want to really focus on tonight, one that might be either challenging for you or one that really might help you grow and learn, and think about how you might focus on that as we go throughout our different activities tonight. I do welcome feedback, and so I'm hoping, I even put out a little blurb on Observe Me. If you're here for that, I would love to know what you think about whether or not I lived my essential elements out throughout this time. And that will help me learn and grow as someone who works on delivering professional development. So here we go. Let's start with a little bit of math. I'd like you to look at this picture and ask, what do you notice and wonder? And if you could take a moment and just type into the chat window what you notice and wonder, I'd appreciate it. And Christabel, I will be putting the PowerPoint available for you. I see, how tall is it? What is it, filled with water, chocolate milk? Are those fake clouds? Is that a ladder? How tall are the trees? Yeah, are there clouds on the tank? Good questions. I'll pause for just another 10 seconds to see if anyone else wants to share what they're noticing or wondering. Okay, so I have some of that information for you. I did some research and here's what I found. In the red boxes, I think are some of the things you asked for. So 130 feet high water tower, which kind of answers that second question. It looks like it's water and not chocolate milk. It says there are clouds made by students from Grossmont College affixed up there. Yep. So yes, they are clouds. Let's see if I have anything else in here. I don't think I have the measurements of the trees, but I have a lot of those pieces you're looking for. So if I wanted to ask and say what mathematical problem could we be solving or what problem could we be solving, if I gave you all that information, is there a problem we could be trying to solve or answer? And more often than not, when I give something like this to people, they say, oh, we could figure out how much volume it is inside, how much water it holds, how much it costs to build it, how much paint they had to put on it, and things like that. But I want to give you a little bit of perspective about it. These are pictures of me and my family in front of my childhood home. I'm the blonde little girl there with my brothers, my parents. And that's a tree in the front yard that we bought for my mom for her birthday one year. And we have lots of memories from that house. So I want to go back to those articles and share with you something, because what's interesting is that that water tower was actually built right on top of our house. They forced us to move. And so you can see in the red box, it says it stands in a residential neighborhood. It was done to save money. Some homes had to be removed, one of which was mine. It left an empty cul-de-sac. And apparently our old neighbor says it's an excellent neighbor because it's quiet and they take good care of it. So obviously he didn't like us as kids running around outside and preferred the quiet of a water tower. And I get that this, you're like wondering, you're like, where is she going with this? I thought this was about PD. But I think this presents to us the challenge that we all have as presenters and as people who develop professional development, is that to me, the picture on the left-hand side causes a very emotional reaction. It evokes memories of my childhood home and of things that were taken away from me as a result of putting that water tower in. And I think the same thing is often true of PD, that as people who develop and run PD, we think that it's just going to be a mathematical problem. And what really happens, or an instructional problem, but what really happens is that teachers often feel an emotional response to it, that we're trying to do something to them that is causing them to feel unsafe, or that we're asking them to change who they are. And I've heard teachers complain and say, you know, that presenter, that person running this, they should live in my world. They should come into my classroom and see what it's like to really teach the students I have to teach. And I've heard people who run professional development say, you know, these teachers don't have any idea what's going on outside their classroom. Their perspective is so limited to inside the room. And I think the point here is that we have to have a little bit of empathy and understanding for what the two sides are trying to come together to do. And so for the next, 45 minutes or so, I'm going to challenge you to try to take the perspective of a learner, but to keep in mind the perspective of the leader. And that means that I'm asking you to look and say, what information in here is new that you can gain or think about, but also which pieces of information might cause a disruption or ask you to re-examine things you do in your own practice. And then to think about what it feels like to be the participant in the professional development that you run and that you do on a regular basis. So hopefully this looks like what you expected based on the description. We're going to look at what elements form effective professional learning opportunities and how they relate to what we know about quality math instruction. And then we're going to have some time for you to really think about your own professional development that you run or the professional learning that you design and think about how you might modify it or begin to design something new. I do have a bit.ly there at the bottom of the screen. And as Cristobal asked, that's where I'm going to dump the PowerPoint once this is over, but there's some other documents that you'll find there. And it's linked to a Google Doc. If for some reason that doesn't work for you, you can email me or send me a tweet and I can make sure you get better access to that. Okay, so here we go. Why do you do professional development? Why do we design it? Why do we lead it? And I'm going to ask you to take a moment, think about it. And if you're brave, share out in the chat window, why do you do professional development? I love these reasons you guys are writing in. Simon Sinek wrote a book about you have to begin with why. And he talks about that when you start with why, amazing things can happen. And he talks about organizations can be built, movements can be led, and people can be inspired. And so I think it's important for us to each think about our whys. And I really appreciate what you guys are writing. Yeah, so let me share with you my whys. And they're personal to me just as yours are personal to you, and that it's what makes us get up in the morning and love our work. So the first one for me is because of something John Hattie talked about. And he talks about the effect size on student learning is huge when teachers become learners of their own teaching. And so to think about what that means in terms of professional development, that teachers have a chance to sit back and reflect on what their teaching is and what that's like to be a learner in that classroom. And I think we can all agree that we need big effect sizes. We got to get our students' achievement to change and for them to be successful. Another reason I do this is because I believe that good is the enemy of great. Jim Collins in his book, Good to Great, talks about we don't have great schools principally because we have good schools. And this reminds me of that lifelong learner idea that learning is a continuous process and not a destination. And that we're helping each teacher, administrator, or participant from wherever they are to get somewhere new and better in their learning cycle. And to think about that progression for each person. I also do this because of a financial reason. And this one speaks well to people on the business side or perhaps school board members or board of directors. If you think about how much money is invested in teacher salary and benefits alone, it is almost always over 80% of the funds a district or a local education agency has. And when you think about that, it's curious to me that we don't spend the money to protect that investment. We spend lots of money protecting our physical resources, our classrooms, our equipment, our technology, I mean, even our textbooks, we spend time and money barcoding them so we get them back. But what are we doing to protect the investment of that money that's going towards teacher salaries and to teachers' benefits? And when you think about that, when organizations put time and money and resources into helping someone grow, that grows their employee satisfaction. And that's been shown to improve the amount of work that they do, employees do, their overall demeanor, their productivity, and also their loyalty to the company, that they want to stay and they want to be there. And in my mind, if we want to grow schools that build this, then we have places where teachers want to continue to work there, as opposed to teacher burnout, as opposed to teachers leaving the profession. We have people who say, I am valued because they want me to continue to learn and grow. I also do this because of something that feels like a calling or a passion, but I look up and I realize the more and more I look at data that we have not reached our goal. We can clearly see we are not serving all of our students in the best way all the time. And that's just not okay with me. And that's why I became a teacher, was to try and do my best to reach that goal. And even though I'm not in my first year and I realize that it's probably not as much of a possibility to make sure that every single child is successful every single moment of every single day, I still feel that calling and that passion to try to make it happen. And I believe that in order to do that, teachers need an opportunity to learn and grow. That we need new strategies, we need new ways of thinking about things, and that we need to consider change and changing our instructional habits, changing the curriculum we're teaching in order to best serve students. So those are my whys, and I want you to keep in mind your whys, because they're going to affect how you view the rest of this this piece. Now that we have the whys, let's talk about what actually makes effective PD. So I'm going to take a brief look at these five pieces of the pie from five sources. It's not meant as an exhaustive list, just a place to start. And I'm going to try to give you a quick overview of each of them, and then I'm going to let you get your hands dirty and start to work with each of them and try to make some sense on your own. So the first one is lesson plans. And so I want you to think back to when you were a pre-service teacher, and you were asked by your, perhaps the person whose room you were taking over, to write out a lesson plan. And I surveyed a whole bunch of teachers and I asked, what were the elements or components on a lesson plan? You guys remember any of the things you were asked to write down? Yeah, definitely Swabat. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are really common ones. Yeah, all of these pieces. So I tried to compile the language that I heard most often from people, and I think I got a lot of your language in there. Some of it's a little bit different, but you can totally tell by district or by textbook what programs people were using or what theories they were following. But here's the ones I heard most often, and I'm looking at them and it looks very similar to a lot of the things you guys just referenced. And so these are the things that people said they most often put on lesson plans. So the message that we heard as pre-service teachers was, if you do all of these things, you're going to have quality teaching and learning, right? And so if you have a goal and you know where you're headed, your lesson's going to be a good lesson. And if you have the right task in front of students and you have the right, give them the right information and you have the right activity, you're going to have a good lesson. And if you give them time to practice where you're there by their side to help them if they have a problem, they're going to have a good lesson. I know Tracy Zager was on here talking last year about closure. And if you have good closure, then you talk about how you had a good lesson and that teaching and learning happened. So one of the things to consider, one of the aspects to kind of draw a correlation to, is which of these things do you use when you're designing professional development? How do you incorporate the basics of planning a lesson or planning to teach into your planning for professional development? Do you work on making sure you have a clear learning targets? Do you work on that set, how you got people into the activities? Do you work on the tasks that you're going to have them involved in? Do you think about how you're going to keep tabs on what they're learning, when they're learning, and how close they are to your learning objectives and using formative assessment practices? Are you going to give them guided practice time? I mean, that's one that we've started to really talk about recently, is that are you going to give teachers a chance to actually practice what they're doing with you near their side so that they feel their confidence building before they're ready to go do it on their own? Have you thought about what closure means? That time to reflect and look back on what they've learned and put meaning together. And so I think it's really important to consider what we learned in basics and not forget that. And now that's not the only thing, but I think that's a place to start. The next thing I'd like you to think about looking at is the mathematics teaching practices. And if you're not familiar with these come from NCTM's Principles to Actions is where you can find them usually. These are not the standards for math practice, so these are not the student actions, these are the teaching actions. And we're talking about what it means to have an effective mathematics lesson, like for what does teaching look like in order to have learning happen. And so what they came up with were these 8 principles or practices. And what was interesting is that even today, I'm going to call out John Stevens was on Twitter, and he put them in an order. We were talking about what he values and thinking about which of these are easiest for teachers, which are hardest for teachers, which are kind of hardest for students to deal with. But the idea here was, if you think about the lessons that really have gone well, that when you were in the classroom and you were like, this lesson just rocked, that you could look back and you could see that each one of these things was being fulfilled. And that when you had a lesson that didn't go so well, when you had a lesson that wasn't quite on the mark, you could probably go back and point to one or more of these things that was missing. So I want you to consider a little analogy, and I'm gonna take you back to the SAT days. If you took the SAT, they used to have these analogy questions, and just FYI, I hated them. But I think it's an interesting little piece there on the bottom. So if you think about these teaching practices and what they say about quality teaching, what would kind of fill in the blank there for quality PD? For instance, if you're supposed to facilitate meaningful mathematical discourse, and that's going to make quality teaching, right? They talk about doing the 5 practices. What should you be doing then? What's the practice you should be doing in order to have quality professional development? And so I think that sometimes we think that working with adults is so different than working with students. But if we're not doing the same things, are we really being effective at teaching? And so my curiosity is how often do you anticipate the responses of the participants on the task you're giving them? Whether or not the task is mathematical, or if it's reading, or if it's responding to something, are you actually thinking about how you're anticipating what they're going to say, how you're looking around the room for the responses? Are you selecting them and sequencing them in order to build some understanding? There's some pieces there that I think sometimes we just we let go and we say, well, they're adults. They're just going to shout out the answer as they go. But what's different when you let people popcorn response versus you make sure that the conversation has a progression towards an understanding? So there's some thinking there, and we'll come back to that in a little bit, but that's a little intro into those teaching practices. I have 3 more for you. This one's from the Center for Public Education, and Allison Ghulamhussein, I'm gonna mess up her name. She was a doctoral student at George Washington University, and she was curious about what made effective professional development. And so she did her dissertation on this, I believe, and she came up with 5 principles. And she, you can see them listed there, that it's ongoing, that there's time to learn, support, modeling. So a lot of you guys said modeling just recently for the last one, variety of approaches, and specific to the discipline or grade level. Which of those is the easiest to accomplish, and which is the hardest? And I wonder if that's interesting. Easiest is to model. Yeah. Yeah. That continuing and that support is not what we're used to in our system. Yeah, exactly. So I think that means that we have to rethink what we're doing, and that we have to think through what that looks like, what does it look like to have something come back in later? What does it look like to allow some time and space and then to come back in and say, okay, what have we learned? What are we struggling with? What's next? And that goes to some bigger principles about thinking about professional development, not as these one and dones, but as not even a year long progression, but maybe a 5 or a 10 year progression, and thinking about where is it we want to see our teachers be in 10 years? And what is it we're going to do each year to kind of get them there? That if we think about a thoughtful planning towards it, and then building in those pieces that you say, okay, here's where we're going to learn something new, and then here's how we're going to support the implementation, or here's how we're going to learn something new, and here's how we're going to continue to learn on the next day or the next month and after that. So those are her ideas, which I think throw some interesting flavor into our conversation. I also have for you guys to consider the work of Helen Timperley. And she wrote a book called Realizing the Power of Professional Learning. And her little graphic starts at the star here. And she says that all professional learning should start at students' needs. So when you look out at your classroom and you see that there's a gap, there's something missing, either it's students' understanding, there's something that they're not able to grasp, there's something that's lacking, that's where it starts. And that teachers then need to make an inquiry into how to fill that gap. That it has to come from this idea of what do I do about that? How do I fix that? And then they acquire knowledge and skills, if we kind of wrap around that graph, to fill the needs of the students. And then they try it out with students. That's the student opportunities. And then they check to see if anything improved. And so this reminds me of improvement science, if you've done any of the work around that. But it's this idea of what is the need? How am I going to attempt to fix it? Did it work? If not, let's cycle back again. And she talks about 6 big shifts. And these are, first and foremost, that it's not professional development, but it's professional learning. And that's talking about taking teachers from a place of participation to a place of engagement, and really thinking about what it means to engage them as learners in the process. Secondly, she talks about students being at the center, not a byproduct. That the reason we are doing this learning is about students being able to be successful in our classes. That when we talk about systematic inquiry, that's really about teachers looking at how to close those gaps between what students need and what they're actually getting. When she talks about focusing on professional knowledge and skills, she says very clearly, it's not the delivery that matters, but the what. And that sometimes we get so wrapped up in the shiny, the shiny package and the pomp and circumstance around it, and we forget that it's actually what was delivered in the package that matters. That then you have to implement it, that's the student opportunities, and then there needs to be time for reflection, which kind of goes back to that closure we had earlier on, that there needs to be a time where you sit back and say, did it work? Was it what we wanted? Did we make a small change? Did we make no change? Do we need more time? And so that's Helen Timperley's work. It's a pretty brief book if you haven't read it. And I've left the information on how to find it below. But that's Helen Timperley's. I have one more for us to consider, and then I'm going to throw you guys into Desmos for a moment. So here's the last one, and that's called the Quality Professional Learning Standards. These came out of the state of California, which is where I'm at. They actually came up with a framework for what kind of standards there should be for professional learning. And I had no idea for many years of running professional learning that there were standards. Think of that. So let me share with you those standards. They're listed in brief here. And I wonder if you're seeing any similarity to any of the ones we've already looked at. So it's rooted in student and educator needs, which is very similar to, I think, what Maria was saying, that needs to be both of them, focused on content and pedagogy. I like the part again about ongoing, embedded in practice, based on data, that you have to have some way of actually looking back and saying, did we accomplish something? The one I think that our principals always forget to look at is the one that's supported by adequate resources. That means that there's time and money to have things happen, and then aligned with other standards. So the cool thing is that they mimic the language that we have in our California mathematics framework, which is that it's not designed as a checklist or workbook for creating a one-size-fits-all professional learning, but it's things to focus on in terms of saying, what are we considering when we design professional learning? So hopefully that's been, I was a little bit longer than I thought, so I'm going to speed up a little bit, but I'm going to give you guys plenty of time to make sense of it. So here's what I'm going to have you do. I made those all into little tiny cards, all those little slices, and I tried even to color code them. So I'm going to go back just really briefly here. See how that one is in red? All those seven things are listed on red cards just to color code it for you. So because we're not in person, I didn't actually physically cut them out for you. I put them in Desmos for you. And I'm going to ask you to sort them into 4 to 6 groups based on commonalities. And what I'm going to ask you to do is essentially try to figure out what each group is as it relates to designing quality professional development. So there might be a group that's all about assessment, if you saw things about assessment, or you might find other commonalities, but that's what we're going to do. I'm going to show you the code, and I think that's where you could go if you like that one. And perfect. Paula put in the link if you like that one. And for those of you guys not familiar with the Desmos card sort, I'm just going to kind of talk as you get in there. But the idea is if the cards look small and if you want to make them bigger, you can click on each card and it'll kind of zoom in on it so you can read it better. But I just took the language straight out of those slides and put them on there. If you want to link them together, you kind of hover one card over another one, and you'll see that they kind of click together and form like a dark blue. I think it's a blue outline around the outside, and they're clicked together. You can put as many cards in a group as you want. And then I'm going to take some screenshots, I think, and let us look at what different people are thinking. So if you're listening to this later on as a recording, it's going to be probably about 10 minutes of random silence or me just jumping in and giving reminders, but we're going to try to do this Desmos card sort. Awesome. I see a lot of people already made it in. Great. If you have trouble, feel free to write a note back in the chat window and we can try to troubleshoot for you. Jackie asked if each group should have one of each color, and not necessarily. So you might find like two pinks that go with the purple, and that's fine. But you're just trying to get them all into like 4 to 6 groups. If the font's too small, you can click on the card and it will kind of zoom in on it. See if that helps. But if you're on a tablet, it might be more complicated. Didn't think about that. I do have copies of all the cards in paper and or in a paper format on that bit.ly that I have on the bottom of the screen in case you want to print them at your house and cut them up and do the activity that way. But Desmos is more fun for me. We need to eat too, Jackie, so go ahead and make dinner. It's totally fine. The cool thing is I think I can leave this open as a Desmos activity. Shelly can correct me if I'm wrong, but you guys can come back later and try it out when you feel like you have more time, if you're multitasking. I know some of you said you have little ones who are demanding attention too. Perfect. Thanks, Shelley. I am going to give this a couple more minutes. I see a lot of you guys making really good sense of this. Yeah, I will definitely keep the activity open with the student code for a while. I'm not anticipating closing it up. So Libria, you can definitely get on later and try it out. Maybe one more minute if you didn't get something together. What I'm gonna do. All right, so I am, instead of showing you the dashboard in Desmos, because there's a lot of us in there, I'm gonna ask us to do a gallery walk in Google Drive, actually. What I did is I took some screenshots of different sets people put together, and I put them in that bit.ly that's at the bottom of your screen right now. And so if you go in that bit.ly, there's a little folder called Desmos Card Sort Screenshots. And they're just little visuals. And if you want to just flip through those real fast and see what people put together, I tried to take something different from several people, but not too many, because otherwise we'd spend the rest of our night here looking at each other's work. But go ahead and look through those. And think about if there's any themes coming across or if you can imagine what those pieces are. Yeah, I can definitely repeat where you're headed. So that bit.ly on the bottom of the screen, the HTTP address, if you head there, there's going to be a folder that's called Desmos Card Sort Screenshots. And if you open that up, there should be... looks like six little images you can look at for how people sorted some pieces together. You can't highlight that. That's weird. Thanks. Yeah. So I know it's kind of an awkward gallery walk because you're not actually getting to walk around the room right now, but as you look at each of those different ones, are you noticing anything? Are there pieces you're like, oh, I hadn't thought about that? Yeah, I like that match too between formative assessment and eliciting evidence of student learning, Martin. I think that really starts to get at what formative assessment's supposed to be about, right? About figuring out what students know and where they're headed and how far they have to go. Now I'm going to share with you what I did when I put these sorted together, and I know I have definitely not given you enough time, and the idea that we're virtual and we don't have an opportunity, or I hadn't figured out how we could really have a really good conversation about this. Like I said, I put the cards on that Google Drive as well, so you can actually download them and try them by hand if that's the way you like to do things, and I said I would leave the Desmos activity open as well. But I try to make sense of them in terms of a way of, if these are all the things we know about teaching and learning, if these are a subset of good quality things that help us have good lessons when we're in the math classroom and good lessons when we're running professional development, how can I make sense of those into some big buckets? And that's the idea of trying to put them into 4 to 6 categories. And so before tonight, this is what I came up with. And I'm saying that because I'm reserving the right to change it. So my categories are going sideways. And so I have four big categories. So that first one is you got to know where teachers are and where you want them to go. And then if you look across to the right, those are the cards that I stuck with it. The blue cards, the green cards, the purple, red, and pink ones. And I said, secondly, I saw a whole bunch of cards. They're kind of all around this idea of you have to design and implement tasks that push teachers towards the learning. That it can't just be about us saying what the learning should be, but there has to be a task. Just like in math class, you can't just say, hey guys, you got to know this. It's how do they experience something that pushes them to have the want to learn it, and then the can to learn it. Then thinking about that support during implementation, and then thinking about that reflect and revise process. And so that's how, and before today that I put them together, every time I talk with people about this, I think I want to make more tweaks to mine and move some cards to different places and maybe even revise my categories a little bit. But the point of this is that if you go through an activity where you take all the different ideas from research and from best practices about what learning and teaching, what that relationship looks like, and you can boil them down to your 4 to 6 categories, your 4 to 6 elements, those become the elements you plan for when you're running professional learning. So even today, for this very short presentation, I thought through, how am I going to know where you're at and where you want to go? And how am I going to design an activity for them towards their learning? How am I going to provide support? That's going to come a little bit later. And how am I going to reflect and revise? Okay, that's on a day-to-day picture. Now, my advice is that you got to change on small steps. And in Southern California, I see freeways built all the time. And I think sometimes we lose sight of the fact that that bridge was not built overnight, that very carefully they moved the freeway inch by inch over one lane at a time. And they built that bridge one row of concrete at a time. And I think that sometimes in professional development, we lose sight of the small steps. And we have to remember that where we're headed with teachers, the change we're looking for is built in small pieces. In the business world, this comes from the book, Four Disciplines of Execution. They talk about the correlation between the numbers of goals you have and the actual goals achieved. And so you'll see that if you have 2 to 3 goals for teachers or their participants, you will probably actually achieve 2 to 3 goals. But if you have 11 to 20 goals, you will achieve nothing. And I think that we need to remember that the focus has to be a reasonable size. Steve Lineman likes to talk about it's a 10% change. That what you asking of individuals has to be a reasonable amount of change. I like to think of the show What Not to Wear that they used to have, where they would have these massive makeovers of the individuals. And that was asking for an identity change. The likelihood of those people having all of that identity changed in a year is very slim. But if I ask them to change one thing about what they do, that's more likely to be a sustainable change. They talk about this also in the book called Switch, which is by the Heath brothers. And they talk about how they have all these practices there. The one I'm gonna focus on today is called Shrinking the Change. And it talks about how you make the change seem smaller. And so if you think about like number talks, if you go out and you say to teachers, I want you to do number talks every day. You should do them as your warm up every day, all the time. That's a big change. If you say to teachers, try it once in the next 2 weeks, and then we're gonna talk about how it goes. And the next time we talk about it, say, can you try it 2 times this next time? And the time after that, could you do it 3 times? Those changes are easier to bite off. It's the idea that you're saying, it's a small change, but I'm going to help walk you towards getting the big change to happen. So think about that first piece. How do you take small steps? The second piece about change, and I'm almost done here because I know you guys have questions too, is to think about your norms. Think about what level of expectation you're asking people to do. If you want compliance, or if you want professionals, or if you're looking for learners. And I was looking for learners tonight. But if you tend to get the norms about, let's speak one at a time, let's limit distractions, that's telling your participants that you want compliance and you want them to act as professionals. But it's not telling them to act like learners. So think through how you say what participation looks like. Think through how you communicate your expectation. We know students rise to the level of expectation we have to them. Adults are no different. Now, things sometimes fail. And my favorite example of this is Pinterest, because this happens to me every time I try one of their beautiful products and try to replicate it at home. When you try to copy someone else's work, it often fails. And that's because you don't know everything that's going behind the scenes. And so Gabriel Magliotti came up with these four reasons. He talks about top-down decisions are one reason it fails. So I'm going to ask you, how are you including teachers in the decision-making process? That's the remedy for it. He talks about lack of variety in the delivery modes. So I'm going to ask you, how are you figuring out how to differentiate? How are you figuring out how to give different types of delivery modes to your teachers? He talks about that there's little or no support in transferring the ideas. So my question or fix is, what support can we make available to teachers? How do we make sure it's accessible? And then the last one he talks about is that the reason it fails is that we have this idea teachers need to be fixed. So this goes back to that beginning statement. What's your why, and how are you communicating that to people? How are you communicating the reason they're there in the first place? So those are all the pieces. I'm putting it all together, hopefully not too rushed for you. But if you think about your essential elements, whatever you deem to be the pieces of teaching and learning that make sense to you, how are you using those to plan your professional learning? How are you communicating expectations for what it looks like to participate in that learning to people? How are you making sure you're taking reasonably small steps? And then how are you setting it up for success instead of for failure? So I'd like you to think through those and think about what's your next step. How could you maybe modify a current PD plan, or how could you create a new one based on those essential elements you came up with? Maybe best based on new expectations, maybe based on smaller steps or thinking about success. And then I'd like you to really consider how we can help each other. So I'll leave those four categories up, because what I'm really curious about is how I can help with that and how we can help each other with that. We're kind of in unique positions, and so learning from each other seems a necessity to me. So I'd like to see how we can partner on that. And I promised Paula I'd leave time for questions, and it looks like I probably did it. So I think this is a good time. What are you thinking of? What maybe are you going to try to commit to doing differently? What's your takeaway? I'd love to hear from you. Yeah, small steps are hard because the people paying your salary often say, I want the big change now. So I always take back those things from the business world and reminding them that any change worth making takes time, and thinking about small steps. These are great. So Libria made a comment in the question window, so I don't think everyone else can see that, but talking about trying to balance asking adults to make small changes when you think about the number of students who are being failed by our system. Hopefully I captured that correctly. And personally, he's talking about how more than one high school failed her daughter and failed to give her a quality education. And I empathize with that, but I think we can probably make bigger fixes, but they're not gonna last as long. So you can probably ask someone to change more of who they are or more of what they're doing. It will likely take more support. It will take probably more time and resources. It can happen. But if you want that change to be sustained, it takes a lot more. And so it's a question that I like to consider with the leadership of the district and to talk about how urgent is this to you? And when you look at your data, how urgent is this a problem to you? Because the more urgent a problem it is, we need the more money and the more, you know, resources in terms of quality professional developers or math specialists to help help mitigate it. And maybe that's something that could be used in terms of a conversation with leadership on giving aid where it needs to happen. I like Mike's comment. Small steps doesn't mean you have to sacrifice big goals. I like that. Shelly, I will be putting my slides into that same Bitly. And if Paula wants to put them somewhere else, she's welcome to do that too, but absolutely there for you guys to reference.
Yeah, and everyone don't, that recording will be here for you to come back and see all of the slides again.
Yeah, I love your guys' thoughts here. Well, if there's other questions that come up, I'm happy to stick around here and answer them. But I also encourage you guys to email me or seek me out on Twitter. I would love to continue the conversation. This is something that I'm continually trying to get better at, is thinking around how we design and implement professional development that helps people change. And I would love to continue the conversation with each of you. So thanks for being here and sharing in this time together. And let me know if there's other questions I can answer.
Everyone, don't forget that we're ready in a couple of hours. So join us again. We're here every week. And if you have questions that you want to keep popping in the chat window, Audrey has graciously offered to stay a little bit longer. I'm going to keep the recording on for a couple more minutes because sometimes things pop up in here and get talked about that others wouldn't want to miss. But this was really awesome, Audrey. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. I love being here. And it was not as scary as I thought it was going to be. So thanks to all of you guys who participated and kept me feeling comfortable too. Absolutely, you can email me. My email's on that last slide right there. And I'm trying to right now dump the, someone else asked when would the slides be in there, and I'm trying to dump them in right now, both as a PowerPoint and as a PDF. The only thing I'd ask is that if you copy the pictures of me and my family, that you be nice about how those are used, because those are obviously personal.
Okay.